the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. The government shutdown is over for at least 3 weeks, and a former advisor to President Trump is indicted as part of the Mueller investigation. Just another busy, bursting at the seams, news-filled Friday in the USA. We'll get into all of it on our weekly politics chat, State of Affairs, plus California Congressman Adam Schiff weighs in. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Yeah, we made it to Friday, and the week is ending with quite a bang.
In a short while, I will sign a bill to open our government for 3 weeks until February 15th.
That's President Trump during a speech at the White House about 3 hours ago. Let's get into that with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. Now, the longest partial government shutdown in U.S. history has ended, and President Trump says back pay is on its way. Meanwhile, California's junior senator steps into the presidential race, and we're going to get into those stories and more with Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. Welcome back, Marisa.
Hey.
Also with us, Rafe Sonnenschein directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Rafe, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you, eh?
All right, Marisa, start us off. This deal will temporarily reopen the government until February 15th. No border wall funding in the deal. What did the president say will happen between now and then?
Well, he's promising bipartisan negotiations over the next few weeks and says that, you know, if not, he still has that potential for an executive order in his back pocket, emergency declaration. But, you know, as you said, he's promising to get workers their pay. And I think that this is a reprieve that, you know, no matter which side of this debate you're on, you should be happy for these federal workers that they're going to be able to collect those paychecks and not face the hardships that we've seen sort of piling up this week.
And Rafe, I would imagine, or I'm wondering if that thing that he has in his back pocket won't be in his back pocket. Will it be right on the table as these negotiations are happening?
I think he thinks he has something in his pocket, which is a second shutdown. I think there's no way that can happen, given what happened with the air traffic control system reaching its breaking point. I just don't think that's there. His other is an emergency declaration, yeah. But there his problem will be Senate Republicans who don't want to set a precedent so a Democratic president could, for example, implement Medicare for All and say there's a crisis in healthcare. So I think he's going to have to negotiate on the basis of the Democrats' deal and probably largely give them what they want.
And Speaker Pelosi has said that this deal, the one that's going on right now, is the same one President Trump could have had 34 days ago. Rafe, it seems like both sides are trying to claim a win. Is that what's happening here?
Yes, although really this was about 100-0 shutout for the Democrats over Donald Trump. So I know there's always a tendency to split the baby and decide everybody should be happy like we used to do in elementary school. But in this case, it's complete defeat for the president, who put himself in a position that if the Democrats took a strong no position, they were going to win. And the Democrats held on long enough to get basically the deal they offered 34 days ago. And he doesn't have a lot to show for it. And I think Republicans were very angry at him for putting them in this position over all these weeks. And that had something to do with his giving in as well.
Now, Marisa, this shutdown lasted 35 days, thousands of people affected in California. Yesterday, we heard from Don Lewis, an air traffic controller at Van Nuys Airport. He told us this.
Some don't have gas money to make it to their facilities and back. Some can't pay for child care. Everyone is taking on more debt.
Marisa, put this in perspective for us. Just how many people were affected here?
You know, there's about 250,000 federal workers in California. Of course, not all of those were in the agencies affected, but we're talking about tens of thousands of people. I mean, the state is huge. And, you know, air traffic controllers, border agents, TSA agents, I mean, the list goes on. And so I think that this is really, you know, we saw the state try to step in and offer unemployment benefits. We saw cities like San Jose come out in recent days and say, we're going to offer you, you know, zero interest loans to make this work. But I think the hardships have been really remarkable. And it is just, I think, to Rafe's point, like, there's no way to spin this that Trump won. I mean, he got nothing that he wanted, and we are in the exact same situation we were over a month ago.
Now, Rafe, Speaker Pelosi and the president engaged in a lot of back and forth these past few weeks, especially over the State of the Union. Some analysts said that for Trump, it was the first time someone with power said no to him. What does the shutdown tell you about what we might expect from that relationship the next 2 years?
Well, let's not forget that elections matter. The Democrats won the House, which allowed her to not only be tough with the president, but to back it up. She basically said, you don't get dessert until you eat your dinner. And no one has ever treated him like that in his entire life. And eventually he realized she could actually have the sergeant at arms keep him from entering the House chamber, and he did back down. I'm not sure things are going to get worse as a result of this. I think she's made her point that he just can't bully her the way he's bullied people. The larger question is whether Democrats will succeed in stopping this notion of taking hostages like the Dreamers and others and refugees and saying, I'll give you back what I took if you give me something else. I think Democrats are pretty determined to not let that pattern continue. Now, the question for Trump is, what does he have after that, since that's been his MO most of his career?
So, Marisa, for Pelosi, I mean, we were talking about winners and losers just a second ago, but for Pelosi, this sounds like it could be a win for her.
I mean, I think absolutely. I think, you know, first take the State of the Union debate, and I mean, she pretty much owned the president on that one. And, you know, she really stood firm. I think we saw her ability to hold her caucus together, her negotiating skills. It's funny, I almost get the sense that Trump respects her because, again, a lot of people haven't stood up to him. And, you know, I think she's been apparently the one person he hasn't been able to come up with a nickname for. So it is an interesting conversation, and I think
what did he say?
What this
I
really
call her
does,
Nancy. Is that what he? That's what
I
he said.
I call her
right?
Nancy.
Yeah, that's her name.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the CNN chyron was no nickname for Pelosi. but you know, I think this does burnish her credentials with her caucus. We did see a tough leadership fight, although there was not actually another person standing up to take her mantle. But you know, there was a lot of on the wings of the party. There was a lot of concerns about keeping her as Speaker. I think probably most members of the Democratic House Caucus are feeling pretty good about that vote today.
All right. During his remarks earlier this morning, President Trump said this.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
Now, Rafe, you mentioned earlier how it probably won't work out the way the president wants, your opinion. But, I mean, February 15th comes and goes. Lasting deal, at least, if not with a wall in it?
I think there's going to be a lasting deal that looks pretty much like the deal they've got right now. I think the Democrats will give him a lot of extra money for border security, and he can call it a wall if he wants. The federal workers finally started to figure out that their individual tragedies are going to be less impactful at ending something like this than the impact on the public of the services they provide, and especially at the airports. And that not only hits everybody, but it also hits the key people who vote in elections, who have a lot of affluence, a lot of power, depend on airplanes. It's the services they provide. It's the bigger question, not just how difficult it is to be a federal worker, although that's very important. They're going to be ready for the next potential shutdown, and they may have been sad and demoralized during the first one. I think they're going to be angry and organized in a second one, and I think very effective from the start. I don't think he's going to do it. And again, I think that his biggest problem now is Senate Republicans who are inching away from bolting on this shutdown thing. If he can't carry them with him, then it's an empty threat, I have to say.
Talking State of Affairs with Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Also, Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. And we're going to be talking about the shutdown a little bit more in just a few minutes with Congressman Adam Schiff. That's just ahead. First, a couple of more major stories that happened this week. Marisa, Senator Kamala Harris officially announced on Monday that she is running for president. That announcement was widely expected. But in interviews afterward, she started facing an important question. What qualifies her to run? So, Marisa, what is she leaning on?
Well, I think she's leaning on her long history of public service. You know, she's a prosecutor. She worked her way up until she ran for DA in San Francisco and then, of course, served as attorney general for 8 years. And so I think she's going to really be leaning on both that public service, that experience at all levels of government, combined with this kind of interesting dance she's doing where she's trying to really talk about that experience and how she understands how law enforcement is necessary and shouldn't be demonized by the left, while also talking about the need for reforms and responsible policing, you know, so that she keeps those progressives that are kind of more her natural base in line with her. Particularly, I will say, I think women of color is a demographic that she really sees as key to any success in a primary battle. So, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of questions about her record as DA and attorney general. And those of us, of course, in the Golden State have a front row seat to everything that happened in the past. So sometimes we're a little too close to it, I want to say. But what struck me this week was really how she was received nationally within the national media and others that, you know, she's being taken seriously as a candidate and is seen as one of the more high profile Democrats to throw their hats in the ring so far.
But Rafe, if you could maybe take the temperature of the Democratic Party for a second when it comes to her record, which we've talked about is a little light when it comes to nationally. Will the Democrats be looking at her more as a symbol of resistance to Trump? And maybe that's why they get behind her.
I think there's no question because she hasn't been in the Senate long. Inevitably, as Marissa says, the focus will be on her work in California. As district attorney and attorney general. That's going to be both good and bad for her because people will pick over every aspect of the record and she'll be on the defensive. The other thing she has going for is not just the symbol of resistance, but her ability to craft a positive message going forward for her campaign. I think when she's on the positive and in the lead of the conversation, she really makes a very, very compelling case. Like all Democrats, they're going to find it's a lot harder when you're answering questions about things that might be a liability and how to kind of answer it quickly, you know, and sort of move on and get back to your message. That's going to be a problem for all the candidates, I think.
Now, speaking about answering questions, Marissa, worth mentioning that there's another part of Kamala Harris's record that could be used against her later, and that's a case that she worked as San Francisco's district attorney. She decided not to seek the death penalty for a gang member who killed a police officer. That was back in 2004. Kamala Harris has long been against the death penalty. Why is this case so important, Marissa?
Well, I think it's just such a flashpoint when it comes to, you know, not just the death penalty debate, but how we treat police officers. Again, I think to Rafe's point, probably wouldn't be a huge issue in a primary, but how do you pivot, you know, in a general election when you have more moderate voters that you need to bring to your side? This is something that has really dogged Harris her entire career since it happened. You know, I think that she interestingly doesn't talk about it in the book she just released, which to me is a bit of a missed opportunity. I think it could have let her kind of define it on her own terms. But, you know, I think it was a tough one for her. And it was something that literally 8 years later, as she became attorney general, she had to sort of go back and try to rebuild a lot of those relationships with police around the state who were very wary of her because of that decision, even though she had just come off a campaign where it was clear, you know, that she did not intend to ever seek the death penalty. And quite frankly, in a city where a supermajority of voters don't support it. But, you know, when a police officer gets killed, I think that, you know, it becomes a different conversation. And having been here at that time, I think one of the things about that decision was how quickly she came to it. I think that in some ways it was sort of the optics of her coming out just a few days after his death and making that announcement as much as what that announcement was.
Go ahead, Rafe. I thought you were going to say.
If Kamala Harris gets the nomination, every Democrat will want her to look at the tape of the Michael Dukakis-George Bush debate in 1988 when he was asked about his opposition to the death penalty by Bernard Shaw. It was a very harsh question, and he gave kind of a rambling answer that you know, didn't really move it ahead very well. There's been many decades now to think this through and to be prepared for that question, and I think preparation is certainly a strength of Senator Harris's campaign, but certainly in the general election, you can just expect that some version of that will be thrown at her. And, you know, being forewarned is forearmed.
And as a prosecutor, I mean, she built up cases, she built up arguments, so that's part of that prep as well.
Well, in the fall, The word prosecutor will play more. In the primaries, it'll be more proving, as Marissa said, that she was a progressive enough prosecutor. But I think the emphasis will be more on the prosecutor side probably in the fall. But look, every candidate's going to have issues like this of various types. Mm-hmm. And it all depends how you respond to it and how you surmount it.
Should she respond to it earlier than, say, being on a debate stage when someone's coming after her for it?
I don't know. The usual rule is if you're spending all your time responding, you're losing. Mm. That basically you try to find a way to continue to talk about what you want to talk about and, you know, keep your answers short, thoughtful, honest, but you can't spend all of your time trying to deal with things.
All right, coming up, we're going to keep going on this. More State of Affairs with KQED's Marissa Lagos and Cal State LA's Rafe Sonnenschein. That's coming up in about 60 seconds, so stay with us. All right, as I just mentioned, we're going to come back with more State of Affairs. And also, Adam Schiff will join us to talk about the shutdown and also talk about Roger Stone. So that's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez, and this is a special edition of State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And with us is Marissa Lagos, political reporter for KQED, and Rafe Sonnenschein, director of Cal State LA's Pat Brown Institute. All right, Marissa, I want to continue with the Gavin Newsom story. He announced Friday that the state will sue the city of Huntington Beach over deliberately blocking affordable housing. What's the story there?
Yeah, so this is actually a long simmering debate between around 50 cities around the state and state housing regulators. Basically, every city is supposed to come up with a plan that includes sort of a mix of housing for, you know, all their residents' needs, so low income up to market rate. And back in 2016, Huntington Beach was actually posed to accept a plan that met with the standards set by the state and the goals set by that entire region. And in the face of a lot of public opposition, they backed down. And so for the last 2 years, the State Housing Authority has been kind of negotiating with them over this. But I think this is really a shot across the bow by Newsom. There was a new bill that took effect in January that allowed the state to actually go to this level of, you know, filing suit. But I would see this as much, as substantive as symbolic. I think that this is a warning shot to other cities who have not been willing to come into compliance. And it certainly fits with Newsom's goal of building a lot of housing and trying to kind of get his arms around the crisis. And I think it marks a real difference from the approach of the Jerry Brown administration to this issue. So quite interesting. And I think there's a lot of angry people in Huntington Beach today over this.
Yeah, Rafe, Newsom in his budget proposal suggested a punishing communities that block new housing developments by withholding state tax dollars. I mean, it sounds like this is something he's going to take seriously as governor.
Yeah, but I think he's going to find that to be a lot harder than he's expecting. The relationship, especially between charter cities, which is a little bit more than 100, about a quarter of the cities, have certain constitutional authorities. And as we found when the federal government was trying to punish cities for defying federal law, the state may not find it very easy to punish cities by taking away transportation funding. It may not be seen as relevant to what their defiance is about. So I think this is going to be a full employment act for municipal lawyers and for lawyers serving the state. A lot of this is going to end up in court. Anybody who thinks the state making local land use decisions is going to be an easy lift is kind of being a bit over-optimistic.
So, Marissa, could this be one of those things where it's one thing to say what you want, but it's another thing to actually be able to do what you want?
I mean, mean, yeah, look, this is clearly the stick approach. But I think that, you know, this law change did impact, I think, the way the state can interact with charter cities. So from a legal perspective, I think they do have a little bit more ammunition than they would have a year ago. And again, I think that this is a way for the attorney general and the governor to show that they're really serious about these housing goals. I think it's going to inform the discussion in Sacramento, where you're seeing lawmakers come forward with proposals aimed at pushing local governments even further. And so, you know, whether or not this plays out in a courtroom or ends up being more of a political battle remains to be seen. But it's certainly, like I said, a new day. And I think something, you know, that this is probably just one tool that the Newsom administration intends to use to try to push cities and counties in a new direction.
And one more thing, Marisa, a Republican assemblyman from San Diego announced that he is going blue. Who is it? And what might that say about the state of the GOP in California?
God, it's not good for them. Yeah, this is Brian Mainshine. He has long been a moderate Republican in San Diego, but this flip actually means that the entire San Diego delegation is Democratic now. You know, we saw a lot of the whispers of this in November. He barely hung on to that district. We saw a lot of congressional seats flip red to blue. And I think that it just speaks to the challenge they're having keeping their members in office and really, you know, attracting or keeping the more moderate folks within that party. You know, he says it's not about the election, but he did mention Donald Trump and kind of where the party's gone and talked about social issues, quite frankly, that I thought were really interesting, that he just seems like he says he's more in line with Democrats than Republicans. So a lot of anger from the GOP side and a lot of kind of I told you so's from that growing number of defecting Republicans in California.
Ray, if I grew up here, if you would have made a bet with me when I was a kid that Orange County would not have a single Republican in Congress, I would have made that bet and added more money to that. What do you think? Is it? I know there's a lot of Democrats in California that probably love this, that probably are very, very happy about this. But is it good for the state to be that blue?
You know, it's hard for me to say having a one-party state really has limitations. I mean, you can make big mistakes when there's no check and balance. I think the ideal would be a strong Republican Party that is fairly moderate on a lot of issues. That would actually be very good for the state. I think at this point, the conservative leaning of the party has made it a really tough partner in negotiations to get problems solved. But, you know, there's a long history of a moderate Republican Party in California that just really has no ability to be heard within Republican council. Someday it'll come back. That'll be good for the state, I think.
All right. Since I don't know if I'm going to be talking to you guys next week, what do you think? Rams win the Super Bowl or not? It's not till next weekend.
Hey, I heard nobody in L.A. even knows who the Rams are.
It's starting to get better for them. I mean, they're not the Lakers or Dodgers, but they're getting there. All right, I won't hold you. Oh, unless, Rafe, you want to give a prediction.
Well, here's the thing. Since I no longer make political predictions as of the last 2 years, I think the Rams are going to win.
There we go. That's safe. Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. Rafe Sonnenschein directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State L.A. Rafe, Marisa, have a great weekend.
You too, A.
The deal President Trump announced a few hours ago to reopen the government is temporary. It will only last 3 weeks. At that point, the president said that if Congress doesn't reach a compromise, the government will either shut down on February 15th or he may declare the national emergency that he's been talking about. So the negotiations continue between Republicans and Democrats. To talk about what comes next, we called up Democratic Congressman and House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff. He first shared his reaction to the deal announced today.
Well, I'm certainly glad that the president finally made the decision to end the shutdown. It should have never been undertaken to begin with. It was completely unnecessary. We can't do business this way, and it caused an enormous hardship. And the so-called deal that the president announced today is the same thing that was offered from the very beginning, which is, let's keep the government open. We can pass a short-term funding bill, and then we can debate homeland security, and we can debate border security, but we don't need to do that while so many Americans are suffering. What we are going to have to do is somehow legislate or find a way to make sure that these shutdowns never happen again, that this tactic is never used again. It's just too singly destructive. But I'm glad it's at least coming to an end, at least for a period of time.
Well, you mentioned, Congressman, now that you can now debate on what happens next. What will that debate look like for the next 3 weeks?
Well, I think it'll look much like the discussion that was going on during the shutdown, and that is Democrats have put forward a number of ways to secure our border. We know that in terms, for example, of drug smuggling across the border, the vast majority of that does not happen between ports of entry. They're trucked in or boated in, and they often come through the ports themselves, and we have lacked the technology and the manpower to detect where these drugs are stowed on these vehicles. So we'll certainly propose to augment funding to interdict drug shipments.
So for you, a wall is still something that is not on the table.
No, it's not on the table, and I don't think it makes any sense. At the end of the day, if we're really serious about border security, there are a lot of good alternatives that we can undertake.
Let's hear a little bit of the president from earlier today.
Over the next 21 days, I expect that both Democrats and Republicans will operate in good faith. This is an opportunity for all parties to work together for the benefit of our whole beautiful, wonderful nation.
Joined by California Congressman Adam Schiff. Congressman, what are Democrats willing to compromise on?
Well, you know, the irony of this is that what the president just called for in that speech was exactly what happened before the government shutdown, and that is Democrats and Republicans in the House agreed on bills that would provide funding for border security and that would keep the government open, and the same happened in the Senate. And the only thing that changed, because the president was prepared to sign those bills, that was the message that Congress got, the only thing that changed was he was criticized by Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and a few other very influential conservative talk jocks, and that scared him, and he decided he needed to shut down the government, and he did. There's plenty of common agreement between Democrats and Republicans on the Hill, and indeed between Congress and the president. There's no common agreement on the wall, however, and unless the president can deliver the votes for it, which he hasn't had, then that's the way the democratic process works. If every president shut down the government because the Congress wouldn't pass their legislative priority, then our government will be shut down all the time, and we just can't afford to operate that way.
You represent the 28th District. That includes parts of Glendale and Burbank. Wondering, this last month, Congressman, how have your constituents been affected by everything that's been going on?
When you look at my district, we have the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and a lot of the folks at JPL essentially work under contract with the federal government. So they were fortunate in some respects not to be immediately impacted, but over time they would have been more and more impacted. And some of the contractors are in a position where they won't get back pay, or they might not get back pay the way actual federal employees will. And so I think there was a great deal of economic uncertainty surrounding the impact on JPL, for example. But at the Burbank Bob Hope Airport, you have TSA workers working without pay, and you've got investigative agents that are working without pay. You've got offices of the Treasury, the IRS, that are working without pay. So I have a lot of constituents, we all do, deeply and adversely impacted by the shutdown.
And I got to ask you before I let you go, Roger Stone, the president's former advisor, was indicted on 7 counts today. I'm wondering what your reaction to that was. That happened right before we got the news from President Trump about the government being open again.
The indictment is significant in many respects. This is now the second person that the special counsel has prosecuted for lying to our committee. And in this case, not only lying to our committee, but also trying to obstruct justice and intimidate witnesses. And so what we're seeing in the indictment is a picture that publicly the president was urging the Russians to hack Hillary Clinton's emails. Privately, someone was directing senior campaign officials to reach out to Stone as an intermediary to WikiLeaks to find out what the Russians' timing was. And clearly, there was far more communication between the campaign through its associates like Stone and WikiLeaks than the public was aware of.
But the Mueller investigation didn't say that those interactions with WikiLeaks were illegal.
No, this indictment is focused solely on lying to Congress and discouraging or intimidating other witnesses from testifying before Congress. And, you know, the question that I'm sure most of the country is asking is, what is yet to come? You know, there are any number of elements of a potential conspiracy, but the question is, are there further indictments in the offing? And we'll just have to wait to find out.
Congressman, you're chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Wondering when we'll hear more from your committee.
We are going to be bringing in witnesses before our committee, holding hearings beginning next month. Some will be involved in the Russia investigation. Others are more broad-reaching. Our first open hearing will be a hearing in February on the rise of authoritarianism around the world. This is, I think, the far largest story that gets lost sometimes in the day-to-day happenings of the Mueller investigation and who's being indicted. The Russians were not only involved in hacking and interfering in our democracy, but they've been involved in interfering with democracies around the world. And even broader than Russia, there is a rise of autocracy globally that America needs to counter. And I think it's incumbent for us to understand what's happening around the world and to be the champion of democracy and human rights that we have been historically.
That's California Congressman Adam Schiff. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, you just heard Congressman Schiff tell us about how some folks in his district have been trying to get by during the shutdown. It went on for a record-setting 35 days with hundreds of thousands of federal workers not seeing a paycheck. Well, now that the government is open, they're all wondering when they're going to get Jerry Maguire'd. You remember that famous movie line, "Show me the money." We'll search for that answer, too, when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. President Trump announced an end to the government shutdown earlier today. As for the federal workers who had been furloughed or forced to work without pay for the past 35 days,
I will make sure that all employees receive their back pay very quickly or as soon as possible.
That was President Trump about 3 hours ago. But exactly when those workers will receive their back pay was unclear. Eric Yoder has been working to get that answer. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. Hello, Eric.
Good afternoon.
All right. Now, as we just mentioned, President Trump said these 800,000 federal workers will be paid very quickly or as soon as possible. Do we know when as soon as possible will be?
Most likely not until later in the week. You have to understand the federal government, like many employers, operates on a two-week pay cycle. The payout for the previous pay cycle was today. So they are going to have to more or less jump into their regular process to gin up a special payout. And under the best of circumstances, that probably will take several days after people are back at work.
Wow, so they still have to survive a few more days before they get any money.
Yes, I'd say that's almost definite.
Wow. All right. Now, because I was wondering, we've talked to federal workers all week long, and they're barely holding on with their fingertips. So I was thinking that maybe they could just get some money right away. But, okay, we'll have to wait on that. Now, yesterday, Eric, in another story you reported for The Washington Post, you detailed exactly how these unpaid workers would be compensated in terms of hourly wages and add-ons. Will they receive even more than they would have with a regular paycheck had the government not been shut down?
They will receive what they would have received if they had worked a normal schedule. Mm-hmm. Now, for many federal employees, required overtime actually is part of their normal schedule. Maybe the biggest example of that would be the screeners at airports. For some of them, they don't work just a 40-hour week. They work maybe 45, 48 hours a week, and they get overtime in addition. So they would receive what they would have received normally under their normal working schedule. There are also many, many complications that are going to arise because there were holidays during this shutdown period.
Yeah.
And there are various special pay allowances if you work on a holiday or if you were scheduled to work on a holiday but didn't. It will take some time to sort it out down to the last penny.
All right. Eric Yoder's reporter for The Washington Post. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump has agreed to end the government shutdown. The immigration fight in Washington is far from over. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, the debate over immigration is playing out at the jails. New Sheriff Alex Villanueva was elected in part on the promise that he would limit the department's practice of handing over immigrant inmates to ICE agents. But as he figures out his policy, it's far from clear how many fewer people will actually be deported as a result. KPCC's Frank Stoltz is here with a deeper dive into all this. Hello, Frank.
Hey.
All right. Sheriff Villanueva made two big campaign pledges. One is that he would, quote, kick ICE out of the jails. I'm wondering if that means he's going to stop handing people over for deportation.
No, it does not. Okay. The sheriff, of course, runs the jails, and each day ICE finds out who is being released. The sheriff department lists that on a public website. And ICE asked the department to hand over for deportation unauthorized immigrants as they're released. Under Villanueva's predecessor, ICE was allowed to use space inside the jails to set up shop and receive inmates. And when Villanueva says he's going to kick ICE out of the jails, it means he's going to force ICE agents to work outside the physical facilities.
Okay, so how would that work?
Well, good question. Will deputies escort inmates to the agents? Will ICE set up shop outside the downtown jail while inmates are released? Claude Arnold oversaw ICE jail operations in L.A. for 5 years.
Set up a command post, put a detention bus right outside, cordon off a section of the street there. I mean, think of the chaos that could cause.
So that's one scenario. Immigrant rights attorney Chris Newman says the sheriff could run into constitutional problems if he holds people past their release time, even by a few minutes, to escort people to an ICE bus.
It is super complex.
So there you have it. Sheriff's officials say they're not sure quite yet how it is going to work.
Now, we talked about a second promise. What was that second promise?
So Villanueva also said he wants to reduce the number of crimes that make someone eligible to be handed over for deportation. Under the so-called sanctuary state law in California, it took effect a year ago. Local sheriffs already are prohibited from handing over to ICE inmates who've completed their sentences for more than 800 nonviolent, non-serious misdemeanor crimes. The law created a second list of about 160 other crimes. Sheriffs have the discretion to turn over to ICE inmates who've completed their sentences for these crimes. This is the list the sheriff is looking at when he says he wants to reduce the number of crimes people can be turned over for.
So that second list, what type of crimes are on that one?
Well, that's the big question. It's complicated. Some are felonies, but the sheriff is really focusing on the crimes that are called wobblers, crimes that can be charged as a misdemeanor or a felony. Some common examples: DUI, domestic violence. Prosecutors often consider whether or the extent of injuries to decide whether or not to file a felony or a misdemeanor in these wobblers. Again, the sheriff hasn't finalized his policy, but he told me his inclination is to say that with most wobblers that are filed as misdemeanors, example, a domestic violence case where someone maybe suffered very minor injuries, that he's inclined not to turn those people over to ICE.
Now, how much would that reduce the number of people that the sheriff turns over to ICE?
Okay, so the latest numbers we have from the sheriff are from 2017. This is when McDonald was still in office. He handed over a bit more than 1,200 people that year to ICE for deportation. I asked Villanueva's immigration guru, Elier Moreon, how much the policy change Villanueva is considering would reduce that number.
Yeah, it'll reduce it a little bit. Not very many.
All right. So what do immigrant rights advocates say about this possible policy change?
Yeah, so we have this sort of nebulous answer. Yeah. Not very many from the sheriff. Immigrant rights advocates are saying, you know, shouldn't be any. Most of them argue Villanueva shouldn't hand over anyone to ICE, that once someone does their time, the sheriff should play no part in punishing them again with deportation. Here's David Aboud, an immigrant rights advocate.
People of Los Angeles issued a broad mandate to Sheriff Villanueva when they elected him in a historic election. And that mandate was to stop working with ICE.
Now, the sheriff's feeling the heat from the other side of the political spectrum on this, right?
Yeah, he sure is. And you don't expect that necessarily in L.A. It's very blue, very immigrant. But here's Greg Suska of Crescenta Valley at a recent Board of Supervisors meeting telling the sheriff he should fully cooperate with ICE in deporting any unauthorized immigrant convicted of any crime.
your dereliction in your duty. Protect the citizens of this state. That's the first job of government, is to protect the citizens.
Thank you.
Now do your job.
Your time has expired. Next speaker, please.
So some might write that off as just some heated comment, you know, in the midst of a debate. But, you know, several politicians, others in law enforcement raising concerns too. Here's Supervisor Catherine Barger at the same meeting. She represents the northern part of L.A. County.
While we're focused on the individuals in the jail, I'm also focused on the victims and victims' rights. And so I think that we need to move cautiously as it relates to that.
Worried the sheriff will end up releasing dangerous criminals.
What does Sheriff Villanueva have to say about all this?
You know, he says that's not going to happen.
So the bad guys are still going to get transferred. That's not going to change. I don't care how many people are jumping up and down and complaining.
So he acknowledged that his approach could leave both sides in the debate unhappy. A lot of cross currents here. Many in law enforcement see ICE as law enforcement brethren, that they should be helping them in all of their activities. Lots of Latino police officers, sheriff's deputies who have families, lots of connections to immigrants who say, hey, wait a minute, I'm sympathetic to Villanueva's potentially new approach. Sheriff told me he's hoping to finalize his ICE policy by the end of the month.
All right. That's Frank Stoltz, KPCC's public safety correspondent. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Last week, in the middle of the L.A. teachers' strike, we spoke with Mayor Eric Garcetti. He was about to get involved and mediate the proceedings. We asked him if he was going to declare a run for the presidency. He said he wouldn't do it until the strike was over. Well, it's over. What's he going to do next? We'll try and find out when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I mean, Martinez. It's been a big week for L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti. He made headlines after helping to negotiate an end to the L.A. Unified Teachers strike. And yesterday he spoke to a national crowd at the U.S. Mayor's Conference in Washington, D.C., where he was critical of the Trump administration.
America right now is crying out for leadership, the leadership that I know exists in this room. Leadership that is focused on winning a future that is increasingly complicated and confusing, if not threatening.
Now, some may think his recent moves seem presidential, but the question still looms. Will Mayor Garcetti jump into the race for president? Here with more is KPC political correspondent Mary Plummer. Hello, Mary.
Hi, A.
All right, let's start with what was supposed to happen earlier today. Mayor Garcetti was going to have a press conference to announce a loan program for federal airport workers who had been going without pay this past month. And that was canceled in light of President Trump's press conference ending the shutdown. But it seems to give credence to this idea that he's acting presidential in the lead up to a presidential bid. I mean, these kind of moves seem to line up with that, right?
This certainly, you know, was another moment where Garcetti was thinking about the national picture. He released a statement after that press conference was canceled that was a bit of a ding at President Trump. In that statement, Garcetti said America needs more than a Band-Aid and that he was ready to support TSA employees if the president brings us back to this point again. Garcetti, of course, is referring to the fact that this is a temporary shutdown. The deal announced today is a 3-week extension of government funding, negotiations over border security, and, you know, that debate over the wall, of course, will continue.
Now, that Democratic presidential pool is getting a little crowded. Kamala Harris recently joined that pool, too. What's the latest on Eric Garcetti's intentions?
Well, the latest update is that there's still no update. His spokesman says they will keep us posted, but there's nothing to say right now. Garcetti told reporters in D.C. this week to, quote, stay tuned. But I can tell you, as you mentioned, Garcetti is certainly sounding presidential. There were a lot of themes in his D.C. speech that could translate to a national campaign. He tried to paint a picture that mayors live in the real world and are adept at fixing problems. He pointed to successes like raising the minimum wage in Los Angeles and helping reduce community college costs. He also went after President Trump, though he didn't mention the president by name. He said the best years are still ahead. It was really a pretty sweeping speech in D.C.
Wondering, though, Mary, I mean, he's kind of had a good week. At least the optics of his week look good. What's he waiting for?
You know, I think the teachers' strike may have complicated his timing decisions. That took a lot of his attention, and getting involved in negotiations was certainly a political risk, but it seems to have paid off. And you can be assured that Garcetti has a team of people really weighing the timing of any potential announcements very carefully. I personally don't think it's going to be too much longer before we hear one way or the other, but I would expect a big media push and very strategic rollout when the announcement comes.
It's that old phrase, it's all about timing.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So, okay, so let's just say if he does get into the race for president, the challenges that are there.
Yes. You know, homelessness, of course, has been a very high profile problem here in Los Angeles. Garcetti has faced criticism for not taking a more proactive role in solving the crisis before the city's homeless numbers really ballooned. And also, we've got that City Hall corruption investigation going on that you've been covering here on the show. Garcetti is not suspected of being a target of the FBI probe, but there certainly is a sense that there's kind of a shadow over LA's City Hall right now.
Now, when it comes to getting into races, one of the things I always hear from politicians, Mary, is that the sooner you declare, the sooner you can start collecting money, collecting campaign funds. So how soon does Eric Garcetti need to get into the race to be competitive?
Political campaign watchers I've talked to say fall of 2019 is kind of an informal deadline. Anyone who's serious about running would need to be in by then. Many, of course, will be in well before then. And in fact, the DNC has already announced a debate schedule that will start this June.
June
of 2019. So it's not too far away. In terms of Garcetti, I think we'll likely know far before that. Part of the calculation here is it takes time to raise the money needed to run one of these campaigns. Top presidential campaigns typically raise between about $50 and $100 million ahead of primary elections.
And the other thing is he'll still be mayor of the city while he's going around the country, so that's a little complication there too. Now, okay, so speaking of fundraising, what do we know about the candidates already running for president, and actually how strong of a fundraiser would Garcetti be, you think?
Garcetti has a reputation for being a masterful fundraiser, but, you know, running for president would be quite a different test for him. The scale is so much bigger. I talked with Bill Whalen. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. He points out it's going to be a good climate for Democrats raising money right now, given what's going on with President Trump. Here's what he had to say.
It's a lot of Hollywood money, industry money in the Palisades and money, tech money in Santa Monica and so forth. It's just a very, very well-parketed area of America. Democrats from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to Hillary Clinton have been mining Los Angeles for years now.
And he's talking there about just how impactful Los Angeles is in this big picture. He says that he expects Garcetti and Harris to really go head-to-head fundraising right here in Los Angeles. So we've got a lot coming up here. California, of course, moved its primary up to March 3rd, 2020.
LA is a political ATM.
Yes.
That's what I've always said.
Yes.
All right. That's KPCC political correspondent Mary Plummer. You can find her on Twitter. Her handle is at Mary Plummer. Mary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, finally, it's just a few more hours until the weekend starts for many of us, so what would you like to do?
Hey, everybody, I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Durant, and we can help you fix that nasty little problem of nothing-to-do-this-weekend-itis.
They say sleep is for the weak, right? Well, this weekend, you can see how sleep deprivation sparks creativity. Members of Zombie Joe's Underground Theater Group present new plays they've written and developed during a 50-hour cram session. It's a 50-hour drive-by theater festival that takes place this Saturday, Sunday, and Monday nights at 8:30 p.m. in North Hollywood. The material is recommended for those ages 14 and up, and tickets are only $15.
Now, here's something for all ages. Everything has a month or a day, like donuts or cats. Well, maybe you didn't know about this one. January is actually National Menudo Month. Yeah, not the band, but the soup. This Sunday in Lincoln Heights, Juanita's Foods hosts a festival called Vive la Tradición. You'll be able to sample some menudo, and pozole too, plus get some agua frescas by Agua Lucha. To keep you entertained, there'll also be folk dancers, kid activities, and live music, including a performance by the granddaughter of Pedro Infante, Lupita Infante. Best thing, this event is free. Finally, don't be a schlamazel by missing out on this last event tomorrow night. And I swear, it's going to be, like, totally gnarly, for sure. So, at the Brand Library in Glendale is the opening reception for Valley Girl Redefined. It's this exhibit that goes beyond that stereotype, and it'll look at examples of how it came to be, but then showcase the other kinds of women that grew up in and helped to define the San Fernando Valley. The party will have beer from 818 Brewing, music presented by girl DJ Lobo and friends, and more. If you miss tomorrow, the exhibition runs until March. Now, there's actually so much more to do than just that. You can head to our full list of events on laist.com. That is laist.com.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran.
See you later. Have a great weekend.
All right, so how about that? First week of Take Two at Two, Monday through Friday. That's where we're going to be from now until the end of time. So make sure you mark it on your calendar. Take Two at Two, Monday through Friday. All right, you can always find us on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me, Twitter and Instagram, same address, same handle for your social media convenience, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Coming up at 3:30 today, it's The Frame, John Horn from the Sundance Film Festival. That lucky duck. All right, we'll talk to you on Monday. Remember, Monday at 2, Take Two at 2. Talk to you then.